Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi calls for the expansion of ties with Pakistan, saying the two sides have decided to increase their annual bilateral trade by $10 billion. Iran says last week's military operation against Israel was carried out to prevent further aggression by the regime and to restore peace and security to West Asia region. And more tensions in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces launch a raid into the northeastern city of Tubas as three Israelis are injured in an operation by Palestinian Sinoplets. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is the news. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president, who is visiting Pakistan, says the two sides decided to boost their volume of trade by $10 billion as a first step. Ebrahim Raisi made the remark during a joint presser with the Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif in Islamabad. Raisi added that the two countries are determined to improve political, economic, and cultural relations. Sharif, for his part, reiterated the two countries' concern over the ongoing Israeli onslaught on Gaza. The premier said Islamabad will work with Tehran toward creation of a Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. Prior to the press conference, Iran and Pakistan signed 8 memoranda of understanding for cooperation in different fields. Raisi is scheduled to meet with top Pakistani officials during his 2-day visit. He is expected to visit Sri Lanka after wrapping up his Pakistani visit. Former Pakistani diplomat Zamir Ahmed Awan was earlier with us to discuss the significance of the visit by the Iranian president to Pakistan.
We are neighbors, we are brothers, we are Muslim countries, and we have excellent traditional friendship between Iran and Pakistan. Definitely, both countries enjoy extremely warm friendship and very active cooperation. But with this visit, relationship will be strengthened further. In the public also, Iran has a very, very good reputation, and people of Pakistan also warmly welcome the president of Iran and his accompanying delegation. Definitely, Pakistan was looking forward for his visit, and there will be an opportunity to develop more trust, friendship, and strengthen the cooperation between two brotherly countries. There are some hindrances from some of the outside countries, and America is the leading that hindrances, but it is up to Iran and Pakistan that bilateral relation we should strengthen, and we should trust each other, and we should promote our close friendship and economic ties. There will be pressure from American, especially the sanctions, but it is still, I believe, that it is between Pakistan and the Iran.
Nasser Kazemi is our correspondent joining us from Islamabad to tell us more about this visit. Nasser, what do you have for us? What are we expecting from the visit of the Iranian president to Pakistan so far?
Kaveh, on the one side, the government is determined to strengthen the relation with the visiting Iranian president. And the meanwhile, the people of Pakistan are very enthusiastic, and they are sending the warm welcome messages to the visiting Iranian president, Mr. Raisi, through their social media platforms. So in Pakistan, there is a vibes about Iranian president arrival here that he is warmly welcomed here because, in recent incidents which have taken place in recent past, especially when Iran strikes, retaliatory strikes on Israel was very hailed by the Pakistani people. Everyone was very happy. And now today the Iranian president is in Pakistan. People are welcoming him. And the meanwhile, both sides, we have seen the press conference of Mr. Raisi and the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Shahbaz Sharif, in which both leaders urged to carry forward these relations. Both leaders have also spoken about the ongoing situation in Gaza. The Iranian president clearly said that the ongoing genocide in Gaza is getting bad to worse day to day, and the international community should come forward to stop this genocide in Gaza. Meanwhile, both countries seem determined to carry forward those projects which are inked between the two countries in recent past. And now we have seen that both Pakistan and Iran vowed to continue this mutual cooperation in the field of trade, in the field of energy, and in the people-to-people contact. So now, after this press conference, there is a schedule of President Raisi. He has to meet the President of Pakistan, Mr. Asif Ali Zardari, and later he will be meeting with the Chairman Senate, Yusuf Raza Gilani, who was the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, as well as he will be meeting with the Chief of National Assembly, the Speaker Ayaz Sadiq. So, and the crucial meeting will be between the Chief of Army Staff, General Asim Munir, and the President Raisi. After this day-long schedule, he is scheduled to fly for Lahore, and he will be meeting with the Chief Minister of Pakistan's largest Punjab province, Mariam Nawaz, and the Governor of the Punjab province. And finally, he will be traveling to Karachi, where he will be meeting with the top officials of Pakistan People's Party, who is in power in Pakistan's largest Sindh province. So this three-day visit will be full of meetings and bilateral talks. Yes, Kaveh.
Thank you very much for that. Nasser Kazmi there from Islamabad. Thank you, Nasser. Iran says the response to Israel's attack on the country's embassy in Syria was a legitimate act of deterrence and in compliance with international law. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said in a weekly presser that the Operation True Promise was meant to prevent further Israeli acts of aggression and to restore peace and stability to the region. Nasser Kanani stressed that the Iranian attacks were successful despite more than 20 countries working together to repel them. The spokesman further slammed the U.S., the U.K., and France for blocking a Security Council statement that sought to condemn the Israeli strike. He denounced Israeli attacks across the region, including in Syria and in Iraq, saying such strikes violate the sovereignty of U.N. member states. Palestinians continue to endure a U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in the besieged Gaza Strip, the scene of death and destruction on a daily basis. At least three Palestinians were killed in an Israeli strike in the city of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Israeli warplanes also targeted two residential buildings in the southern Rafah city, killing 19 Palestinians, including 14 children. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reports that some 54 Palestinians were killed and 104 others injured in Gaza in the past 24 hours. That brings up the total number of victims since October 7 to 34,151. The number of those wounded has also risen to almost 77,000. On Saturday, the Palestinian Civil Defense said bodies of over 200 Palestinians buried by Israel in a mass grave were recovered inside a Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent, Mutiaba Musaba, to get the latest updates regarding Israeli attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip. Here's what he had to say.
The last night was horrific for the Palestinian people across all areas of Gaza Strip, whereas the Israeli occupation forces persisted and continued their airstrikes against all areas of Gaza Strip. And let me begin with the latest attack that targeted a group of the Palestinian civilians here in Deir al-Balah city in the popular market in the central area of Deir al-Balah city. The Israeli warplanes targeted a group of the Palestinian civilians. Multiple and dozens of the Palestinian casualties were left behind that attack. Over the last night as well, the Israeli warplanes carried out an airstrike against a residential building in Al-Prouk neighborhood in Deir al-Balah, in the southern part of Deir al-Balah city. The entire residential building was completely destroyed over those attacks. And here, in addition to that, in the central area of Gaza Strip, basically in an Nusayrat refugee camp, the Israeli warplanes also continued and intensified their airstrikes against the northern part of Nusayrat refugee camp. Several Israeli airstrikes hit that area. In addition to that, the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained against those areas, including Al-Mughraga neighborhood, Al-Zahra town, and Gaza village area. In addition to that, multiple Israeli shells actually targeted the upper floor of the Al-Awda hospital in Nusayrat refugee camp. The entire solar panels there were completely destroyed and devastated over that attack.
The Chief of Intelligence Directorate of the Israeli military has resigned over failures leading to the October 7 unprecedented Hamas anti-regime operation. Major General Aharon Haliva is the first high-ranking Israeli official to step down for failing to prevent the attack. In his resignation, Haliva said the intel division under his command did not live up to the task that they were entrusted with. The Israeli general demanded what he called thorough investigation into factors and circumstances that led to the attack. The resignation comes at a time when there are deep divisions among high-ranking Israeli officials over the failure of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to handle the Hamas operation. Israel has also witnessed mass protests for the past 6 months, with demonstrators blaming Netanyahu for his handling of the war on Gaza. Israeli forces carry out yet another raid in the occupied West Bank amid simmering tensions in the region. The regime's military targeted the northeastern city of Tubas in the raid. During the incursion, explosions could be heard across the city. Israel has stepped up its raids across the West Bank since the regime began its onslaught on Gaza on October 7. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance fighters have carried out an anti-Israeli operation in Al-Quds. According to initial reports, three Israelis were wounded in the suspected car ramming attack. Palestinians say that such moves are in response to decades of Israeli atrocities. The regime has killed at least 482 Palestinians since October 7. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier told us about the fresh Israeli incursions into cities across the occupied West Bank and Palestinians who are fighting back.
The Israeli military claims that a Palestinian arrived at one of the, bus stations inside Al-Quds, and he rammed his vehicle into Israelis there in two different incidents, and that two Israelis had been wounded and transferred to hospitals inside Al-Quds. The Israeli military is claiming that this attacker, as they are saying, succeeded to flee the scene and left the area last night, and after the late hours of the night, Israeli settlers raided the village of Burqa near Ramallah. They set ablaze a number of Palestinian vehicles. They tried to burn a Palestinian home, and at the same time, the Israeli settlers set fire to a sheep barn, and they slaughtered a number of goats and sheep, according to the residents of Burqa. And at the same time, the Israeli forces raided the village of Burqa in order to provide cover for the Israeli settlers. The Israeli forces, meanwhile, stormed several areas across the occupied West Bank. They raided Qalqilia, Tobas, Maythaloun, South Jenin, and northern occupied West Bank. In Balata refugee camp, East Nablus, exchange of fire have taken place between the Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces. And the Israeli troops stormed Douma village south in Nablus and arrested a number of Palestinians there.
Balance Hezbollah resistance movement says it has shot down an Israeli drone over an area in the southern part of the country. Hezbollah said the targeted drone is Hermes 450, adding that the operation was carried out in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The group has downed and intercepted several Israeli drones in recent months. The Lebanese resistance movement and the Israeli military have been trading fire since October the 8th, one day after the regime launched its genocidal war in Gaza. Hezbollah fires missiles and rockets at Israeli military sites in northern occupied territories, while Israel targets residential areas in southern Lebanon. People in different parts of the world continue to turn out in large numbers to protest against the ongoing Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. In the Canadian city of Toronto, people have once again hit the streets to demand the government end its support for the Israeli regime. Earlier, our correspondent Camilla Escalante, who was present at the rally, joined us with the details.
Well, I'm in downtown Toronto, and once again, like every weekend, hundreds of people, if not thousands, are coming out here today to protest against the genocidal Zionist regime holding of hostages, of prisoners, for, of course, we know, many decades. That's the theme of this weekend's march. There are people here who have gathered alongside different organizations affiliated actually with their neighborhoods, because within the last 6 months, these organizations have kind of spurred up and began organizing locally against the genocide, and in order to approach their ministers of parliament and to try to tell them that it's simply not acceptable that they not call for a ceasefire. And now the demand has become a total two-way comprehensive arms embargo between Canada and Israel. They said some of the things that the Canadian government has done thus far have been only symbolic. A lot of expressions from the Canadian government of concerns with what's going on with Gaza, but not anything substantive in terms of actually trying to end the genocide in Gaza and Canada's complicity. It's also really important to say, one thing that we've been reporting for several months is that there is a significant amount of material that has been gathered by the International Center for Justice for Palestinians, a group of lawyers, academics, and experts, about the possibility of a case against Canada at the ICJ in the same way that Nicaragua has taken Germany, the German government, to the International Court of Justice. Lawyers here in Canada say that they also want to take the Canadian state to the ICJ for its crimes, saying they have even more of a case than the case that exists against Germany.
France is being accused of increased repression towards their Muslim community since the start of Israel's genocide in Gaza. A protest against Islamophobia was initially banned, but thousands turned out despite the attempt at judicial intimidation. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
Dozens of organizations marched in Paris against Islamophobia and racism as Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing has caused increased state-sponsored repression against Europe's largest Muslim community. A main theme of the march was protecting children. Since October 7th, children as young as 10 years old have been charged with so-called apology for terrorism, while a child of 8 was falsely targeted for praying during recess. Scandals like those have many saying that non-white children are no longer being treated like children, but instead like suspected fanatics, delinquents, and full-grown adults. As France is accused of targeting Muslim children at home, their elite are giving military and political cover to Israel's mass murder in Gaza of an estimated 15,000 children and the orphaning of some 20,000 others. A decade ago, during another Israeli invasion of Gaza, France became the first country to ever ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They banned pro-Palestinian demonstrations for a month after the counterattack by Hamas on October 7th, handing out hundreds of thousands of euros in fines and making mass arrests. Police initially banned this march, claiming it was a threat to public order and possibly anti-Semitic. That was overturned at the last moment, but many say the effort is proof of a long-running double standard against non-whites and non-Jews. Similar to during France's two-year state of emergency starting in November 2015, many have been shocked by the lack of outcry at this latest targeting of the Muslim community, despite perpetual bragging of being the alleged birthplace of human rights. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that does it for World News. This is bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Muslim countries on auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr, on April 10th, 2024.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and our Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and his untainted, pure, immaculate, guiding, and well-guided chosen progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate all the honorable people here in this meeting, including the honorable officials from various organizations within the country, as well as the entire Iranian nation on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr. I would also like to extend my congratulations to our guests here, the ambassadors of Islamic countries, and to all the Muslim nations. We hope, God willing, that this Eid will be a true celebration and a source of joy and blessings for the entire Islamic Ummah.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
First of all, I feel it necessary to once again refer to the special spiritual atmosphere of the month of Ramadan in our country. The reason I emphasize this is because we should appreciate and preserve the spiritual atmosphere, which included gatherings for reciting supplications, beseeching God, praying the prayers in groups, thriving mosques, people helping others, and giving iftar, the meal for breaking the fast, in mosques and on the streets. In other words, people truly showed their merit during this month of Ramadan in spiritual aspects with their recitations of the Quran and other practices, in social aspects by providing assistance and financial help to people, particularly the underprivileged, and also in political aspects. The rally that took place on Quds Day was a remarkable international political move. Where else can you see such a thing? The information that we have received this year from the experts that we are familiar with tells us there was truly a public outcry in the country on Quds Day. There were larger crowds than seen in previous years. These are truly something to be grateful for. I sincerely thank our dear nation for taking the initiative and moving forward in all of these different fields. However, merely expressing our gratitude in words to our dear nation is not enough.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Dear listeners, this is the second part of A Window to Palestine. A Window to Palestine.
Ya estamos de regreso para seguir las conversaciones que hemos tenido.
We are now back to continue the conversation we had to learn about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile. Today I invite you to talk with Valentina Salvador Huagui, a Chilean doctor of Palestinian origin, who has been working recently since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza with a group of doctors to try to help. Let's learn a little bit more about Valentina through the following video.
Un poco más sobre Valentina.
Valentina Salvador es nieta de palestinos.
Valentina Salvador is the granddaughter of Palestinians. She studied medicine and is a specialist in surgeries for oncological diseases. She learned the love of cooking from her grandmother and grew up with recipes that she still continues to prepare and that connect her with the cultural traditions of her homeland. In 2017, she traveled to Palestine as part of a program that brought together the diaspora from different continents. She returned with the memory of a kind, happy, and welcoming people who enjoyed life with simplicity despite the tensions of the occupation, the wall, and the many shortcomings. As part of the Doctors' Society of Palestine, where some 300 specialists participate, they began to pressure scientific societies to play a more active role and denounced the genocide. The events, however, have led them to continue their work raising funds to send medical supplies through the Chilean embassy in Egypt. Valentina believes that not only is the lack of food and water serious, the treatments that were left unfinished, the lack of vaccines and the lack of medical care in short are also other slow and silent ways of exterminating the Palestinian nation.
Hola Valentina, muchas gracias por haber aceptado esta.
Hello Valentina, thank you very much for accepting our invitation. You are third generation. On what date and for what reasons do your parents migrate here?
Acerca de la llegada de tus padres.
I'm sorry, your grandparents.
De mis abuelos, sí. Daniel, muchas gracias por la invitación. Un honor.
Well, of course, my grandparents. Daniel, thank you very much for the invitation. It is an honor to be here representing the Doctors of Palestine. Look, my family on both sides come more or less before the Nakba. It was mainly as a result of the persecutions by the Ottoman Empire. For example, my family name is Salvador. My grandfather arrived in Chile around 1910. Several of his children were born in Betlalal, but my grandfather was born here in Chile, in the town of Catamu, where they settled upon their arrival in Chile. On the other hand, in depth, my grandfather's wife, Victoria Issa, came to Chile directly from Palestine. Around 1929-1930, my grandfather's father arrived here with them, and from there, in the bottom line, the family has settled in this land.
Aquí hay dos eventos que es importante destacar.
Here there are two events that are important to highlight. It was around the First World War that the Palestinians arrived. Turkish Ottoman Empire decided for the first time to force the inhabitants to defend the empire in any possible wars that might arise. And they began, for the first time, to recruit the firstborn children, the eldest of each family. And that makes many Christians and also Jews send their children out of Palestine to avoid taking them to the war. In the case of the grandmother, she surely came because of the great general strike of the 29th, where the colonization process had already begun, and we were at the gates of the Nakba, but the Nakba was already planned. This is very interesting because this also generates surely the same thing that happened in your family. A generational gap. The children of that do not have much of a relationship with Palestine. They do not pass on the language, for example. And it is always the third generation that recovers Palestinianity. What was that process like? What was it that set it off? And what are you up to today?
¿Qué fue lo que lo detonó y en qué estás hoy día?
Mira, tal cual como tú dices.
Look, just like you say, it happens to me also. Well, obviously, in my parents' house, they spoke an Arabic language. And being born in Chile, they kind of had to recover everything because in Chile, things were a little different. It's just like you say, they kind of experienced Palestine in the house.
Cosa que para nosotros fue diferente.
Something that was different for us. I think I get emotional because of the topic, sorry. But I think I have returned to it. I come from a school with a lot of social sense, a lot of politics. I don't think I had ever questioned it, like where it comes from. But yes, I think it was my dad who instilled it into me. Regardless of the fact that I seldom spoke, there was always these Palestinian things in my house. Always, always. Everything had to do with it. Food, traditions. And I think this provoked my sense of curiosity to investigate what this Palestinian thing they were talking about is. So I started to investigate, to learn from history. When people spoke to me, I liked to have information and tell them what this is, what Palestine is, what is happening, because they asked me at school. Deep down, there was an important Palestinian group that would talk about the issue of Palestine, and sometimes I felt like I had to participate in such arguments. The Palestinian issue always resonated in my head. It's good, it catches my attention, because I'm the most Palestinian-like person in my generation.
In fact, you are the first to travel to Palestine.
Exactly. In 2017, I said that I really have to go. I have to see what happens. And in addition to being the most beautiful trip of my life, at the same time, it is also a very powerful trip.
You're also sensations and emotions only. I mean, it is not verbal information to transfer, but implicit information that comes not only from traditions, but also from the undeclared relationship that is always present in our lives. What was it like to return to Palestine?
Mira, yo el año anterior al viaje leí el libro de Lalina Merwan, El Volverse a Palestina.
Look, the year before the trip, I read Lina Meruana's book, Becoming Palestine. It affected me deeply. It was really the sensation I felt. And when you get there, as you say, it is like a feeling of being found, of happiness, of belonging, of understanding your origin, of identifying with all that, and at the same time, of feeling that they have this tremendous bond with Chile. Everyone watches Palestino soccer matches. Everyone has a family. They ask you, do you know this one? Do you know that one? And this really exists. Although they are so many kilometers away, but at the same time, it is so close, near our hearts. And you see the people, how they are in their houses, what they have in their houses, and you say, I am from here.
Well, we must highlight one thing that is geographical and not many people are aware of. Palestine and this metropolitan region are at the same degrees of southern and northern latitude, and therefore they have the same seasons, they have the same fruits, they have the same types of food, and they are also very similar in terms of geographical situations. After the October the 7th attack, you, together with a group of doctors, and also Teresa Chomali, who already has more experience in this, formed this group of doctors for Palestine, and they took on the task of trying to bring medical missions to Gaza. This group today has no way to operate in the current situation in Gaza and act against the humanitarian crisis that has generated this genocide. This has been carried out throughout the West. It is no longer just Israel. South Africa has also filed a lawsuit against the United States and England for complicity. What do you want? And what progress have you made to reach doctors in Palestine and help them to be able to collaborate?
Look, the truth is that it has been very good in many ways. This group that was formed was born from desperation, I would say, from Teresa Chomali, from seeing how little we could do. The truth is that the organizations from civil society, above all us as doctors, can do little about it. So at the beginning of November, she created this WhatsApp group in which actually we experienced something like an explosion of ideas, of political thoughts, of what to do and what not to do. And from there, Teresa created a committee, and I am a member of this committee, which has enabled us to organize different things. Because in the first place, we know she's already in contact with people there, and because we see it, of course, in the media, that currently it is impossible at this moment to do something to go there. But since we felt the need, we started to do a campaign in which we are raising money to purchase medical supplies and give them to the hospitals. We have received information and are aware of the needs. Hospitals are the first first priority. There are plenty of needs, but we have to narrow them down and see what we can really send. As Doctors for Palestine, we went to the Chancellery and we were very well received there. The Government Fund of Chile was committed to helping us in every possible way, that is, the delivery of these supplies. Because it has happened that Chile even donated money to UNRWA and other entities, but this money is wasted on probably other needs of another type. So the idea is that through the Embassy of Chile in Egypt, we are going to purchase these supplies and they are going to help us deliver them directly to the hospital directors who are directly in charge of receiving these aids.
If someone wants to join Doctors for Palestine, how do they do it?
Look, we have this WhatsApp group. There is an Instagram account named Doctors for Palestine also. Via this account, one can also contact the group, and there in the Instagram group, you will find a form that must be completed that helps us organize better and get to know each other. As doctors in Palestine, many of us have different specialties, but we did not know each other before joining this group. We didn't know that, for example, we work in the same place sometimes. So this has been quite fruitful in terms of being a means for knowing each other who are in Chile and working together. And then through Instagram or WhatsApp, we will invite the volunteer to join us. And we are also doing now a campaign which is about the donation of 250 million pesos. We are also doing a bingo, and we had it in the previous week at the Palestinian Club with the aim of reaching this goal of 250 million of pesos. This money is going to be used for medical supplies.
Very good. A question that many of the doctors and the doctors who are seeing us are going to ask themselves. Is it only the Chilean doctors of Palestinian origin, or can Chilean doctors also participate?
No, una muy buena pregunta. De hecho, hay muchos médicos no palestinos.
A very good question. In fact, there are many non-Palestinian doctors. There are doctors who have even gone to the missions in Gaza who know the place perfectly but have nothing to do with Palestine. In fact, many of them are here through their acquaintances. There is even a group of doctors who have canceled their vacations and donated their money to fund for our campaign. They are not even Palestinians, but they say what matters to them is the humanitarian aspect of this issue. The point is that we cannot understand. There's tremendous violence here, there's a catastrophe, and we are in a lot of pain and a lot of despair, but as a civil society, we cannot do anything. So we have a prepared group of approximately 50 people. We hope to eventually be able to go there. The desire is there, and we just need permission. The truth is that there is so much destruction and everything, and we know there is a huge need for our specialties. I mean, imagine with everything that has happened, like the number of diseases that are probably obsolete in that area. There have been no vaccinations. The need for cancer checks, need of the post-war wound, the need for plastic surgery. The needs are multiple and huge. So really, as a group, we hope to be able to do many more things. We hope to achieve the required money, and we have to raise it to fulfill our goals.
Well, here's another example of the great distance that exists between the Western governments that are complicit in the genocide and the civil societies that around the world today are mobilizing to support the Palestinian people, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and Jerusalem al-Quds. I thank you, Valentina, for accepting this invitation, and I wish you much success in the initiatives that you are undertaking. Greetings to all the participants of Doctors for Palestine group.
Thank you very much, Danielle.
Let's take a break, and we'll be back in a minute to learn a little more about the history of the Zionist project and how it has affected Palestine.
These Israelis gathered to watch the bombardment of Gaza while enjoying soft drinks and snacks. People dragged plastic chairs or even sofas to the top of a hill and cheered on their military as if they were watching some sort of sport.
They chose to rule them. It's their fault. They got it to where it is now, not us.
But don't you think you'll get worse by pulling them?
No, I think that's the only solution.
I think
they should just clear off all the city. Just take it off the ground. Yes, I'm a little bit fast.
What's wrong with these people? Thank you.
During the Arab-Israeli War of 1948, more than 700,000 Palestinians are forced into exile. It is the Nakba. It means catastrophe in Arabic. The Haganah forces search for the Arabs, and the barricades are set up to identify those who have not abandoned the city. The Haganah is a paramilitary organization that constitutes the core of the Israeli forces and is responsible for the expulsion of Palestinians. Some of them flee on their own will just to escape the violence. Their lands and houses no longer belong to them. Most of them go to Gaza, Jordan, Lebanon, or Syria.
Los videos que acabamos de ver nos muestran
just show us three different facets of the Zionist project. First, some Israeli citizens are enjoying watching the genocide from a hill in the occupied territories and cheering their army doing what the Nazis did with them. It is as if it were a film made in Hollywood. Second, we see an Israeli project, a real estate project to be located in the Gaza Strip, a coastal area oriented towards the north and with tourist potential, highly desired by Western imperialists. Third, we see images of the Nakba and all the destruction and this whole plan known as the Plan Dalet to expel about 700,000 Palestinians, destroying 500 villages, and the life, history, and geography of those who had lived in this territory for centuries. Well, let's see the story on the maps to see the evolution of this, to see if, indeed, as Finkelstein said, what happened on October 7th justifies what came afterwards. Does what has happened in the last 75 years justify the complete dismantling of a fascist and neo-colonial regime like that of Israel? This is Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century, where Jews, Christians, Muslims, and atheists lived together without any problem and in absolute peace and brotherhood, with a proportion of the Jewish population close to 5%. Shortly after, in the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, Theodor Herzl, recognized as the father of contemporary Zionism, presented his project called the Jewish State to form a Jewish national home in Palestine. Of course, the lobby carried out throughout the West and with the main powers of the time allowing them to achieve in 1917 the Balfour Declaration, known as the formal beginning of the Palestinian tragedy. Great Britain, the current England, without having any right to do so, committed themselves to the Zionist organization and to give Palestine a group of foreigners coming from all over the world. This declaration was put into practice by an illegal immigrant that sought to change things on the ground and change the proportion of the population. In 1947, the population of Jewish religion was about 30%, but above religion, the Zionist population came in, but not only as refugees seeking support, but to start the programs of Tsarist Russia and also the Nazi Holocaust. They came to usurp everything. They made the newly born United Nations, which had been created from the failure of the Society of Nations, approved the partitions of Palestine, an organization that was established to protect the right of self-determination of the people, approved the partition of Palestine. And guess who were not invited to the meeting? The Palestinians. That is, in complete absence of the main owners of the land, they gave 55% of historical Palestine to the Zionist organization and 44% divided into three unconnected zones to the Palestinians. Clearly, there was no possibility that either of these two states would be consolidated as they were intended. Obviously, the Palestinians rejected, but Zionism also rejected it and advanced in the war of 1948 until it occupied 78% of historical Palestine in 1980. What we know today as occupied territory remained in the hands of Jordan and Egypt, but this lasted about 20 years until the war of 1967, where Israel made use of its great military power and its always strong support from the Western powers, and mainly from the United States, from Europe and Germany, tried to pay the blame for the Nazi Holocaust with Palestinian blood. They advanced on the entire territories and on the heights of the Syrian Golan and a strip of Lebanese territories that remained occupied for more than two decades. Today, after years of extermination, after years of a genocidal policy on the parts of Israel with the Oslo Agreement, the Palestinian territories are reduced to a 15% and also in the form of small bastustans without connections to each other. In such a way, they not only intend to drown the Palestinian population, but also the Palestinian economy. Now they continue encouraging or forcing in every possible way the Palestinian population to leave the place. But we Palestinians have resisted stubbornly. We have stayed on the lands to which we belong, and we have no intention of abandoning this land to make way for the continuity of the neocolonial Zionist project. And that is why we today face an ongoing genocide in Gaza, because the leaders of the Zionist project have understood that the foreigners can never defeat those who have remained in this land forever. I offer you the floor. We have time for two questions, please.
Un saludo.
Greetings. My name is Jorge Avedrapo. Here is my question. It is true that the Zionists considered several options, territorial options, to carry out their projects among some Latin American countries. I mean, finally, what could happen in the future at a global level if the advance of Israel's colonial project is not stopped?
Efectivamente, Jorge, entre el primero y el cuarto Congreso Sionista.
Indeed, Jorge, between the first and the fourth Zionist Congresses, most of them held in Basel, Switzerland, several alternatives were put into discussion, including Uganda and Chilean-Argentine Patagonia. The underlying theme was that there was no excuse that could be used to expel the inhabitants of these territories, and therefore they resorted to the myths of the biblical promise and the chosen people to sustain a colonial project like Zionism. And that is why Palestine ended up being chosen. Furthermore, if one looks at this as a projection not only of a Palestinian issue, because the problem is not only here. This is a problem of the global North-South confrontation, and therefore what happens in Palestine will have an intimate relationship with what happens in the Western Sahara, with what happens in other parts of the world, in Gualmapo, in our country, where the hegemonic classes, world imperialism and transnational imperialism must do everything possible to protect the interests they harvest through occupying every inch of this territory and controlling every inch of the market and effectively appropriating any common property or natural resources. This strategy exists in the world. Therefore, from my humble perspective, the only possibility of reaching a just solution in Palestine is the overcoming of capitalism on a global scale.
Es la superación del capitalismo a escala global.
Hola, mi nombre es Carlota.
I am Carolina Spina. I am president of the Luis Emilio Recovera Collection and Research Center in Zeiler. My question is, why is the word apartheid used to refer to the Israeli policy against Palestine?
El apartheid es un concepto que se utiliza.
Apartheid is a concept that is used to refer to states or societies where there are two different systems inside them. For example, in South African apartheid, where within the same country, South Africa, there was a system for whites and a system for people of African descent. This system is seen today in Palestine and also in Israel, because not only within Israel there are first and second category citizens and different systems for those who are historically Palestinian and for Israeli citizens, but things are also tough for those who have recently arrived there and have just adopted Israeli citizenship. That's because they are Zionists and have many more rights than the Palestinians who have lived in Israel since before their birth. In addition, what we are seeing today in Gaza and the West Bank is a situation where the Israelis and the occupation, the illegal occupying power, the illegal Israeli settlers have all the rights, but the Palestinians have none. That is why the word apartheid was coined, and that is why it has been expanding the possibility of everyone recognizing the Israeli occupation as an apartheid system. We must never forget that in 1974, the United Nations General Assembly decreed that Zionism was a form of racism, homologously comparable to South African apartheid. This is while, due to the changes in the correlation of forces and North American and European pressure, this resolution was annulled several decades later. But this has not annulled the spirit and essence of Zionism, that in all these years, nothing has changed.
Lo he mencionado en otros programas.
I have mentioned it in other programs, and I reiterate it today with more force than ever. Palestine, in its 5,000 years of history, has lived only 120 years of peace. The Palestinian people consisted of an ethnic strain absolutely intercultural, composed of Jews, Christians, Muslims, atheists, belonging to diverse peoples who have settled in Palestine at some point in history. They have been there since before the first invaders arrived, and they will surely be there after the last ones leave. Today, thousands of supposed Israeli citizens have abandoned Israel because they no longer feel safe among the Palestinians. The Palestinian nation sink their legs and roots into the ground of their homeland, where they are born, grow, and die. That's because Palestine is their land. I invite you to watch this program next week to learn more about the concept of genocide in Gaza. Don't miss the next episode of A Window to Palestine.
En el próximo capítulo de Ventana a Palestina.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to attain ultimate perfection as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So what a beautiful title we have on today's program, and that is how to attain ultimate perfection as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So to kind of, start to tread some of these shallow waters before we get to the deep end of the pool, is that Islamic lifestyle is what will help us to achieve ultimate perfection, right? A lot of times we go to, these, non-religious, or perhaps we can call them secular spiritual gurus and, sadhus and these kind of obscure, spiritual, secular kind of things that we kind of fall into, because we're looking for spirituality. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there who take advantage of this desire for spirituality of a human being. And they kind of get in there and they give you these kind of weird prescriptions, and then they ask you for money eventually. And, it's like a Ponzi scheme that people don't really realize what's going on. And, it's interesting, when it gets really serious, we have this concept which is called Irfan-e Kadhib. It is translated as this Irfan, the spiritual wayfaring, which is false. It is based upon falsehood, or it is based upon incomplete truth, right? It's based on either one of these, but the consequence and the repercussions are the same, and that is danger and harm
Well, there you go. Danger and harm is what the consequences of this pseudo-secular, you know, spiritualism, which is based upon falsehood or half-truths. And that's something that we need to really be careful from, because yes, we want to attain ultimate perfection, but it is not done via these means. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about attaining ultimate perfection as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So in the previous segment, we kind of set this fundamental pillar or foundation, which is that if you want to attain ultimate perfection, if you want to attain spirituality, then the way to go is Islamic lifestyle. There is no other substitute for spirituality and for attaining perfection. The only, complete and perfect and comprehensive, remedy or solution is Islamic lifestyle, and that too of the pure Muhammadan Islam, the Islamic lifestyle of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, and the infallible and immaculate Imams alayhim assalam. This is the Islamic lifestyle which will lead to ultimate perfection. So that's the second fundamental pillar. Don't go out there into this obscure trying to gain spirituality. You're just going to lose yourself, and you're going to do your spirit and your soul some serious damage. It's not worth it. Don't waste your time. So go to the Islamic lifestyle. And of course, the Islamic lifestyle is not something that is, incredibly difficult. Right, Allah says in the Holy Quran that we have made religion easy for you. The purpose and the goal and the end result of ultimate perfection is nearness to Allah. As we say in all of our actions, Qurbatan ilallah, I seek nearness to Allah. That nearness is ultimate perfection, and it is attained via very simple but profound things, such as fasting in the holy month of Ramadan, going to the Hajj, Zakat, Khums, right? The five daily prayers, the wajib prayers, recitation of the Holy Quran, the mustahabat and the recommended things, and moral and ethical virtues. That is what's going to help you attain ultimate perfection as a part of your Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be covering Iran's response to Israel's murderous missile assault on the Iranian consulate in Damascus earlier this month. The corporate media once again failed in its duty to report accurately about Israel and typically resorted to simply parroting Israel's version of events. But contrary to what Western political leaders and media commentators have said, Iran's drone and missile strike, codenamed Operation True Promise, did achieve its objective, as Latif Arabouchaker will explain in this report.
In what CNN reported was the largest drone attack in world history, the Islamic Republic of Iran struck at the Zionist entity on Saturday, the 13th of April. It was in response to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, carried out a fortnight before. CNN also noted it was an operation which seemed planned to minimize casualties, in stark contrast to the previous 6 months of the Zionist genocide in Gaza. According to the Zionists, the operation was ineffective in that 99% of the drones and missiles launched were intercepted. But, of course, as the experience of the resistance axes shows, the most efficient way to defeat the Iron Dome system is to overwhelm and confuse it. In addition, however, it is plain that the missiles which did strike home, in particular at the Nevatim airbase in the Naqab Desert, caused significant damage to the base. F-35 aircraft departed from here to bomb the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Western media are very reluctant to even mention the other major target, an intelligence base for Israeli military intelligence known as Unit 8200. The Zionists tried their best to suppress all mention of the attack on the top secret base, which, as the Israeli press has previously noted, is the first line of defense in preventing surprise attacks, and is an outpost that has been labeled the eyes of the nation. The chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces, Major General Mohammad Baghari, noted that the operation against Iran in Damascus was directed from here,